Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
Happy Thanksgiving. It's one that 16,000 American troops are spending in Afghanistan, which has been racked by violence today. There was a car bomb this morning. Then Taliban fighters attacked a guest house belonging to the U.S.-funded organization International Relief and Development, also known as IRD. The Afghan police reportedly have maintained control of that compound. And there was other news. The Afghan parliament has just ratified a security agreement with the U.S. What will that mean for those troops spending time there? NPR's Sean Carberry is also in Kabul. There might be a little delay on our phone line with him. But, Sean, when our producers were emailing and texting you over the course of the morning, you had to stop many times to find out what is going on. There was so much going on. So what have you found out about the attack on the IRD compound?
Well, Afghan officials are saying it has ended. There were two militants who were finally killed, ending the standoff. It began with an explosion outside the compound and then these two militants trying to fight their way in. There were gun battles with Afghan security forces for a couple of hours. There were NATO aircraft circling overhead. And again, eventually they did kill the attackers. And the only known injury so far was a Nepalese security guard who worked at the compound. So very typical Taliban-style attack of a suicide bomb outside to try to breach their way in and then fighting until the militants are killed. And again, as I say, at this point, only one report of one person injured in this attack.
Yeah, but then there are the other deadly attacks, not just in Kabul, but around the country recently. There was that gruesome suicide bombing killing more than 60 people at a volleyball tournament a few days ago. What's your sense of security there?
Well, this month in Kabul has been dramatically different to really anything I've seen in the couple of years that I've been here. The frequency of attacks, there have been attacks on convoys, there have been attacks on Afghan forces, there was an attack on a member of parliament. Just this morning, a suicide car bomber drove into a convoy of British embassy vehicles, killing one British national as well as an Afghan who worked at the embassy and several other Afghan civilians. And I've talked to some Afghan Ministry of Interior officials, and they say that the Taliban have made a dramatic and intentional shift to start attacks in the cities, saying they're trying to create chaos and terrorize people. And Western officials are speculating that part of this is also because of the drawdown. There are fewer foreigners out and around the country. And therefore, in order to attack them, you have to go where they are, which is predominantly in Kabul and the main cities at this point. So Afghan officials say, look, there's going to be violence. They're trying to do what they can to stop it. But the Taliban are looking to make an impact in the cities right now.
Well, but, you know, a drawdown. But then, as we're hearing, U.S. troops are going to be allowed to stay longer and fight the Taliban. So what is this security agreement that was signed today? How does that dovetail with all of this?
Well, this agreement now has been ratified by the Afghan parliament as of today, and it guarantees that somewhere around 10,000 U.S. troops are going to remain after this year. They are supposed to carry out two missions. One is counterterrorism operations to go after any remnants of al-Qaeda or affiliated groups, and then to continue training and assisting Afghan forces, which is now likely to include continued air support and possibly sometimes U.S. forces being out on the ground with Afghans, advising them, assisting them as they're carrying out operations. So as of now, there are definitely going to be U.S. forces here for at least the next 2 years. And obviously, the Taliban have said that they will continue to fight until all foreign troops are gone. So it's set up this dynamic where people expect this violence to continue.
Well, and you sat down with the troops having Thanksgiving dinner today. What were some of the things they told you?
Well, privately, some of them did express some concern about the uptick in violence in Kabul, especially those who do ride around in convoys that have been targeted quite extensively this month. But publicly, they were quite festive today. They were enjoying a big Thanksgiving meal at the dining hall at the main base here in Kabul. And I talked to Captain Ben McKenzie from Dothan, Alabama, and he's actually on his first deployment to Afghanistan. And he says, you know, while he's missing his family and Thanksgiving at home, he's happy to be here.
is kind of a sensitive time, and we're excited to transition from enduring freedom to resolute support. And this is a critical time where we aid and assist the Afghan people, and we're pleased to be here to help to do that.
The voices of a troop member in Afghanistan, brought to us from Sean Carberry, NPR's Kabul correspondent. And as we know, some of these troops, as we just said, might be staying longer than they thought. But Sean, we just want to comment to you. Extraordinary work for a long time now out of Afghanistan. Thank you. You're spending your Thanksgiving there as well. So happy Thanksgiving to you.
Thanks. Happy Thanksgiving, Robin.
There were arrests in Los Angeles and Oakland and demonstrations in other American cities, but also in London last night, protesting the grand jury decision to not indict Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson in the fatal shooting of Michael Brown. In London, over 1,000 people held placards that read Black Lives Matter and No Justice, No Peace outside the U.S. Embassy. Ferguson itself was relatively peaceful last night. But was Natalie DeBose able to make her Thanksgiving Day commitments? Natalie is the owner of Natalie's Cakes and More on South Florissant Street. Her business was shut down when riots first erupted over the shooting last August. And this Monday, her shop was damaged. But both times, people came forward to help, including this time, what she calls 11 angels who helped her make deliveries today, and two strangers, Chris Foley and Dave Swingle, who started GoFundMe campaigns to raise money for her. And that's put her sort of in the middle of the debate over what's happening in Ferguson. And Natalie is hard at work today, but stopped for a second to talk to us. Natalie, happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Well, we're wondering if it's a happy Thanksgiving for you. First of all, take us back to when you realized that your window had been smashed. We understand a customer, a neighbor, called and said, you know, he witnessed people breaking it. What did that do to you?
I was hurt. I was just experiencing extreme anxiety as I got closer to the building, just to see the damage of the window and the product and supplies that was in there. I'm just being all covered with glass. I was just hurt.
Yeah.
I really was just hurt.
Well, I'm imagining also frightened because you had made commitment to people to get cakes and things to them on Thanksgiving. We know that there were two online GoFundMe campaigns that started for you. Neighbors called and said they'd come in and help. What did people do?
They just extended their arms of love, through their words, through their finances, through their prayers, through their songs, their physical beings just coming in here with brooms and dustpans and bags. I actually had a guy just was driving, was in the area. He came over with the wood, and with some other guys on the street, they were able to board me up that particular night.
Well, this is what happened the first time in the summer when the shooting first happened. It wasn't as if your shop was damaged, but nobody was coming to it because it was at the epicenter of all these troubles.
Absolutely.
And you didn't have a customer for a couple of weeks. I know you went on a local radio station just to talk about it. What happened after that?
When I came back from that particular radio segment, there were a line of people at my door. And they said they didn't know. They didn't know that it was this bad, and they just wanted to help. They just wanted to help. And so for a couple of weeks, it was a consistent flow of traffic coming through the door. But then as the anxiety built up about the release of the indictment, the traffic kind of slowed off a little bit. There's just been kind of like an elevator motion going on.
This is what we're understanding, that this that has affected the mood in the city has directly impacted the businesses in the city. I want to ask you more about that, but let's continue the story, because did you make your orders today, and how did you get things out?
I've been up for about a little bit over 26 hours, so I'm a little tired. Mm. However, like I said, the volunteers, the calls, honestly, that's what gave me the strength to really get it all done, because I knew I had this reinforcement coming in this morning. I started with a few this morning around 5 o'clock because I had a few customers that needed to get on the road. The rest of the orders were done by my 11 angels that came in and handled it for me. So I'm just truly grateful.
Well, not only that, the two GoFundMe campaigns, we understand, have raised nearly $100,000.
Yeah, I'm still in amazement. I don't think that has even sunk in yet, because I've been on a constant flow from Monday night, from cleaning, coming back in Tuesday morning, cleaning up some more, not really getting an opportunity to bake till late Tuesday night, early Wednesday morning. It just hasn't settled in. And the young lady, Ms. Chris Froby and David Slingle, they keep in constant contact with me to let me know how it's doing, because I just don't have time to get on the internet and check it out.
You mentioned the two people who started GoFundMe campaigns for you. One of them is David Swingle. And, you know, that raises a question, as I know you know. He has been vehemently tweeting against the riots, in fact, blaming the riots on civil rights leaders like Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton. He's retweeted tweets that say things like, "The only thing you people in Ferguson have managed to accomplish in all of this is to live up to the ghetto stereotypes. Congratulations." So he's on one side condemning the riots. On the other side, you have people like Jelani Cobb, who said, "Well, look, our country is rooted in a revolution, rioters overthrowing the British government, and this is what happens when people feel they have no other recourse." Here you are, smack in the middle of this. How do you feel about the people who damaged your shop?
I honestly haven't been able to think about that. That's the number one question that all the reporters are asking me. What would you say to the rioters that damaged your property? You know, what would you say? How do you feel? Honestly, outside of being hurt, I haven't been able to even think about it. Mm. My main priority here at my shop is that this is my only source of income. I have two children, an 11-year-old daughter and a 7-year-old son, that depend on me to make it for them. And if I can't work, then I can't provide a living for them.
Yeah.
And so my mind is not even thinking in that direction yet, because I'm trying to make sure the business is sustained so that my children are sustained.
Yeah. And this is a business that you built by selling cakes at flea markets to get the money to do it. And
yes, ma'am.
Putting one foot in front of the other.
Yes, ma'am, all the way down the line. Well, absolutely.
Well, and doing it as we speak to you. So you know what, Natalie DuBose, we're going to let you go to continue your work today.
Thank you so much.
She's the proprietor of Natalie's Cakes and More in Ferguson, Missouri, and she is delivering them as we speak to her. So, Natalie, thank you, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Thank you. Have a great one.
Mystery lovers are mourning the death of a master of the genre. Phyllis Dorothy James, Baroness of Holland Park, died today at the age of 94. Better known as P.D. James, the creator of the cerebral detective and published poet Adam Dalgliesh. Her 14 books in that series sold millions worldwide. Though her novels centered around death, Baroness James herself was full of wit, as we discovered when we spoke with her in 2005 after the publication of The Lighthouse, her 13th Adam Dalgliesh book. Our interview begins with Baroness James reading an excerpt in which Dalgliesh and his team had just been called to a case on an isolated island retreat. But one member, Detective Kate Miskin, has some reservations.
Somewhere, as yet only imagined, a body was lying in the cold abstraction of death. A group of people was waiting for the police to arrive, some distressed, most apprehensive, one surely sharing her intoxicated mixture of excitement and resolve. It had always worried her that someone had to die before she could experience this half-guilty exhilaration. And there would be the part she most enjoyed, the team get-together at the end of the day, when Adam Dalgliesh, herself and Benton Smith would ponder over the evidence, picking up, discarding, or clicking the clues into place as they might the pieces of a jigsaw. But she knew the root of the small sprig of shame. Although they had never spoken of it, she suspected that Dalgliesh felt the same. With this jigsaw, the pieces were the broken lives of men and women.
Just in that reading you gave us, there was a phrase in there that jumps out, sprig of shame. What is that sprig of shame that these detectives feel approaching a case?
Well, I think Kate, who's really a very sensitive woman, does hugely enjoy her job. And it's immensely exciting, that first moment when you see the body and the mystery is before you and you know you're going to solve it. And someone has died, and died horribly. And she is always aware, as is in fact Adam Dalgliesh, they're always aware of the victim, the suffering of the victim.
In fact, there's a passage where Detective Dalgliesh reflects on, you know, how the Secret Service has this sort of, as he puts it, or as you put it, half-ecclesiastical patina of authority bestowed on those who dealt in esoteric mysteries.
Yes.
Another way of saying, you know, people sort of envious of detectives.
Yes. You have quite an aura around you because you are dealing in these matters which other people don't wholly understand and, in fact, haven't access to.
Well, P.D. James, that also reminds us, in the New York Times rave review of your book, they called it a Scrabble lover's joy or something like that because of the way you use those words. Now, you could have just said detectives have an aura. Instead, you said half-ecclesiastical patina of authority. You know, how much do you enjoy using
words? I love using language. I think in English, we both our countries are so lucky because we have the most beautiful, the most versatile, and the richest language in the world to use. And, you know, as a writer, it's a great privilege to use it and to try always to use it better.
Well, which is probably why your policeman is also a poet.
Yes.
An unusual and unexpected detective. This is the 13th in the series. You've sold millions of books. What do you think is the appeal of Adam Dugleish?
I think the books appeal to people who do love the mystery. They do want a hero, but they want a hero they can respect, a hero who is a complex and interesting and sensitive human being. I think the attraction, perhaps, of the books as books is the attraction of all mysteries. You know, the story, the puzzle, and the fact that you are going to get a solution, so that, in a sense, the mystery is a small celebration of order and reason. It presupposes we do indeed live in a rational and comprehensible and a moral universe, even if there seems sometimes to be a great deal of evidence that we don't.
Well, this particular mystery, your newest one, has been compared to Agatha Christie's 10 Little Indians, all the suspects isolated on an island. Was that an homage?
No, not at all. No, in fact, when I decided to set it on an island, I thought, well, I hope people don't just think of Agatha Christie, because it's been a very popular setting, I think, for a number of mystery writers, because, you know, you've got your suspects all there neatly together, cut off from ordinary life, and that's extremely convenient.
Oh, sure.
I didn't want to be compared with Agatha Christie.
Oh, okay, then we're not. We won't, except in the finest of ways. But that is a classic mystery form.
Indeed it is, because you can't allow the stain of suspicion to spread too far. You've got to have a little group, because you can only deal with about 5 or 6 serious suspects if they're all to be real human beings, you know.
Well, and the victim on this island, poor thing, is Nathan Oliver. He's a writer, not too sympathetic, because he exploits other people in the service of his writing. For example, he gets a reformed alcoholic to fall off the wagon so he can write about it.
Yes.
What are you saying about writers, P.D. James?
Well, Graham Greene said, of course, that writers have a splinter of ice in the heart. And I know what he meant. They stand aside from human experience and suffering and observe it and use it. And I think to an extent that has to be true. But of course this writer is a particularly disagreeable one. He's used it all his life, ruthlessly.
But what about you, P.D. James? Do you have a splinter of ice in your heart? I can't.
Well,
believe it.
I hope it isn't a very big splinter, actually, Robin, if it's there. But I think there is always a writer, the ability to stand aside from experience and observe it. For example, if I had a friend who was in great distress over something or other, and I was trying to comfort her, I would be feeling absolutely, genuinely compassionate and loving, and would put my arms around her, and all that would be genuine. Part of my mind would be observing myself doing it, observing how her distress manifested itself, so that perhaps 20 years later I had to describe a scene in which somebody was being comforted, that experience would come back.
Well, you're very honest about that. I think some writers might not confess that.
Well, I think one should be honest, and that seems to me that that can happen.
And we understand you began your writing to support your family.
Well, I didn't really, Robin. It's a very understandable misconception. My husband did come back from the war mentally ill, so I had to earn my living, but it wouldn't have been a realistic way of doing it, frankly. You know, you couldn't possibly rely on it. I went into the National Health Service and got a job, a good, safe, bureaucratic job with a cheque at the end of every month. But the books, they did provide, as it were, the jam on the butter.
By the way, I'm sorry to hear about your husband coming home from the war, as you said, mentally
ill.
Yes. How much did that drive you into writing? Or
I don't think it drove me into writing, because I knew from very early childhood that's what I wanted to be. But it did mean I was rather later beginning than I might otherwise have been, because, you know, I had to do the job and go regularly to the office and visit him when he was in hospital. And it wasn't very easy to start that first book.
Well, P.D. James' new book is called The Lighthouse, Another Adam Dugleish Mystery. I want to ask you as well, before we let you go, here in the U.S., we've had this incredibly popular trend of CSI, Crime Scene Investigation television programs.
Yes.
Where the latest in technology and computers, and they come in and, you know. Yeah. How do you feel about the new treatment of crime? Do you try to work that into your books, or do you stay with the old-fashioned gumshoe, thinking it through cerebrally?
Well, Robin, you have to. You just have to bring it in. If you're trying to write a realistic one, I mean, we all know about DNA and what the extraordinary effect of DNA has, you know, on criminal investigation. But what I think is important, and I'm sure it is important in real life, is not to forget the old skills of, you know, door-to-door knocking, talking to people. I mean, it does amaze me how often with horrific crimes, when somebody is at last arrested, it's somebody the police have had on their books or have seen before, you know, and actually interviewed. So I think you need both the technology and the old-fashioned detection skills, which are rooted, really, in an understanding of human beings and how they act.
Author and Baroness P.D. James speak to us in December 2005. She died today at the age of 94. In the upcoming advertising tsunami that culminates in the Super Bowl, you won't be seeing much of Budweiser's iconic Clydesdales. The company has decided that instead of the beautiful horses, they'll feature 20-somethings, vampires, and Twitter hashtags to lure young drinkers away from craft beers and back to their, well, their grandfather's drink of choice. Here's one of the new ads featuring millennials holding bottles of Bud, talking about missing their friends.
It is sad how much I miss you people.
I really need one of your hugs.
Also bring your sister. I'm just kidding. That was just once.
We're already over here.
Pick up the new Budweiser Holiday Crate and tell us who you want to share it with.
And there's also a Twitter hashtag, Holiday Buds. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He's writing about brands in the digital age and joins us from the NPR studios in Washington. Derek, your thoughts on what Budweiser's doing?
I think it's a really clever advertising campaign, but separately from the aesthetics of the advertising campaign, I don't think it's going to work. I think that there are sort of two distinct headwinds. The first headwind is that for a long time you saw Budweiser fall as light beers became popular. Now you're seeing Budweiser lose ground because craft beers are becoming popular. It's just not obvious to me where Budweiser wins this war. Young people have decided that they like light beer, and when they want to have the heavier stuff, they aren't going to Budweiser. They're going to more interesting, smaller shops that just speak more to sort of local origin and significantly more flavor, if I can add a little bit of editorial spin there, than Budweiser, frankly. Yeah.
Well, what other brands are going through this kind of growing pain?
Well, so it's interesting. There's a lot of brands right now that are sort of famously coming upon tough times. You know, you had BlackBerry go through this. Microsoft is trying to reinvent themselves now as a productivity haven for young people. In the information age, brands are really suffering. And they're suffering because a brand is a signal. It's a signal of information that tells people, here's why you should buy this product beyond price, beyond what it looks like. And that signal is being diluted in the age of information because there's simply so much stuff that we can consider. It's so easy to look up how good something is, how well it was reviewed, whether our peers like it, that it is weakening the power of brands to hold on to customers for a long period of time.
How does this dovetail with how brands are using something you call cult theory to maybe lure people in?
Right. The idea here is that brands are losing their influence as markers of quality, but they're shifting their marketing efforts towards something else, identity. And so you saw in that Budweiser ad, you're trying to get young people to say, Budweiser is connecting me with people. It's social glue. That's what Budweiser stands for. There's this idea in cult theory that people join cults not to conform, but actually to become more individual, that cults are groups of people rebelling against a mainstream coming together to feel more unique. And so I track how this has worked across social media, across some sharing economy companies. But I think you see this in a lot of places, that more and more advertising is based around not what are the specs of this product, but rather who are the kind of people that buy this. And can you, if you buy this, be that kind of person?
It's so interesting because, again, again, you see somebody lining up for the latest iPhone or for the latest sneaker design. They look like lemmings to you if you're outside of it, but it is making them feel more individualistic, fascinating, and we'll probably be seeing more of those friends beckoning friends to drink a certain beer and be part of the crowd. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
More than three decades ago, the Supreme Court made it clear judges can't jail people because they're too poor to pay court fines. That would, in effect, bring back debtors' prisons, which were outlawed in the U.S. before the Civil War. But as you'll hear in this special encore presentation of an NPR investigation called Guilty and Charged, correspondent Joseph Shapiro found people across the country still being sent to jail for unpaid fines and fees.
Debtors' prisons were outlawed in the United States nearly 200 years ago. And the U.S. Supreme Court, three times since 1970, ruled that people can't be sent to jail simply for being too poor to pay their court fines and fees.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court.
The last case was argued in 1983.
This case involves the revocation of an indigent's probation for his failure to pay a fine and restitution, which was...
That's Jim Lohr, who argued Bearden versus Georgia. Lohr was just out of law school when he got assigned what seemed an insignificant case. He spent long hours in the county law library.
I mean, it was a long shot, and I guess I just didn't know any better to ignore that, so I went ahead with it.
He was representing Danny Bearden, a young man charged with breaking into a trailer. Bearden was fined several hundred dollars, but then he lost his factory job. He knocked on neighbors' doors asking to mow lawns. When he couldn't pay the rest of his fines, he was sent to jail. In Bearden, the Supreme Court ruled that judges can't send someone to jail simply because they're too poor to pay their court debt, only if the person had the ability to pay but had willfully refused. NPR looked at courts around the country and found, in the three decades since Bearden, there's been an explosion in the use of fines and fees. Services long considered free now carry a charge, sometimes hundreds of dollars. NPR reviewed the laws in 50 states. 43 states now allow people to be charged for their public defender. When someone goes to jail, they can be charged room and board in 41 states. When they're assigned a probation or parole officer in 44 states, they can be charged for that too. We also found wide variation in how judges determine who's too poor to pay. And so every day, all around the country, poor people go to jail because they can't come up with the money.
No, I'm not surprised. I see it all the time, even people that works for me.
That's Danny Bearden. 31 years after his Supreme Court victory, he's a supervisor at a small textile plant in rural Georgia. He sees people, his coworkers, his neighbors, his friends, get charged for things like driving offenses, fines and fees that now can add up to hundreds, even thousands of dollars.
They're just poor people, okay? They got families and everything like that. They work a job, and... Even when they get behind in trying to pay, they go to jail.
People like Stephen Papa. He served in Iraq with the Army National Guard. But when he came home to Michigan in 2012, he couldn't find a job. He was homeless, counting on friends to give him a couch to sleep on. Papa admits he was wrong that day last August when he and some friends spent the day drinking.
It was kind of embarrassing because I'm not that type of person, but we had got highly intoxicated and climbed onto the roof of an abandoned building. There was a hole broken in the window, so we went inside, and then we got surrounded, and then we got arrested.
Papa speaks from the Kent County Jail in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He was sentenced to 22 days, not for what he did that day he was drunk, but because he couldn't pay his court debt. In a recording from the court session last September, Grand Rapids District Court Judge Benjamin Logan says he wants $50. But Papa had only 25.
The wrong answer. My expectation is $50, and I just sent three people to jail. Didn't happen.
The judge wanted a first payment on the $2,600 that Papa was charged in restitution, fines, and court fees. The judge said Papa could have made money by picking up cans to recycle.
My finances were like absolutely zero.
Pick up cans. You know?
Papa said he tried. And the only reason he had even $25 in his pocket was because he'd built a shed for a friend's grandparents.
Make it work. How old are you?
I'll be 27, sir.
You ain't gonna be 27 not having any initiative, did you?
No, Your Honor.
You know how to hustle legally and earn some money?
Just the week before, Stephen Papa had found a job, a good one, paying $12 an hour making steel shelves. He told the judge he'd get his first paycheck at the end of the week, and then he'd have the money to pay.
Well, I just wanted to add, Your Honor, like, I've been trying. I tried really hard to get this job, and I'd really like to keep it.
But he wasn't sure that job would be waiting if he spent 3 weeks in jail. Still, that's where the judge sent him, and added a condition to his probation for when he got out.
You're to maintain stable employment, provide proof thereof.
In other words, if Papa didn't have a job when he got out, he'd be in violation of his probation and could go back to jail.
I tried telling the judge, like, throwing me in jail is going to do no good. You're not going to get your fines like you want, and I'm going to lose my job, and you're really not going to get your fines if I don't have a job. And it's just, I don't know, it just baffled me.
It's left the judges to make the difficult calculation. Who's too poor to pay, and who can but didn't? And we found sweeping discrepancies across the country over how those decisions are made. Some judges will tell an offender to give up their phone service or quit smoking cigarettes and use the money instead to pay court debt. Judge Robert Swisher, a Superior Court judge in Benton County, Washington, says he'll make a judgment based on how someone presents themselves in court.
They come in wearing expensive jackets or maybe $1,000 worth of tattoos on their arms. And they say, well, I'm just living on handouts. But they're wearing expensive clothing and expensive tattoos. Those are things you look at.
Attorneys who defend poor clients say the Supreme Court's Bearden decision requires courts to more formally consider a defendant's ability to pay. But they say it almost never happens. Defendants don't know their right to ask for a hearing. And for judges, those hearings would clog up the court schedule. Lauren Brooke Eisen, an attorney with the Brennan Center for Justice, faults judges for not doing enough to find alternatives for impoverished defendants. They could assign more community service or even waive some fines and fees.
Fines and fees create new pathways back to jail and prison. You're just sending these people back for not even committing a crime, but just missing a payment.
I called Stephen Papa, the Iraq vet, after he got out of jail. When you got out, was your job waiting for you?
Yes and no.
Right away, he called his workplace and was told
that my position was filled, but the boss was going to try to find some work for me just to help me out.
His boss did call him back to the factory when another worker got injured, but that was to fill in for just a few months. Now he's found the new job that he likes as a security guard, but it pays a lot less, $4 an hour less. To stay out of jail, Stephen Papa needs that full-time job and to keep paying the $40 a month that he still owes the court. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
And since his story ran last spring, Michigan Supreme Court has taken this up, and the legislature is considering bills to end so-called debtors' prisons.
Why do we love the apocryphal, a cherry tree falling, but forget the Choctaw sending money to feed the starving Irish just 16 years after the Trail of Tears? Wherever we came from, we left mules and gulls behind. But somehow, we swept rain into our disposition. We feel clouds gathering, miles above the sugar beet region and agro farms based in Topeka. Did they ever exist, DeSoto's green fountain or the threshed abundance on Cather's floor? Newer, faster, behind our heat is a fever. Even in religious fervor, said our prince Walt Whitman, there's a touch of animal heat. Maybe only a truly great stranger can see it, said Kerouac to Robert Frank. You got eyes.
That's David Roderick reading After de Tocqueville from his new collection of poems, The Americans. The former poet laureate Natasha Trethewey said the book is a meditation on the ways we go about our lives, unmoored from the facts of history, though we drift along its shore. That's familiar terrain for Roderick. His previous book, Blue Colonial, reimagined his hometown, Plymouth, Massachusetts, where English colonists first settled in 1620. We spoke with him about that on Thanksgiving Day 2006. And David Roderick is with us again for Thanksgiving 2014. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving. Thank you for having me, Roderick.
Oh, it's our pleasure. And as are these poems. Although we're not always singing praise.
No. I think the word meditation that Natasha used to describe it is an accurate word, I think. It's a series of meditations, I think, on the big, messy, beautiful project that is our country. There's beauty and faith and grace, and there's also some grit and some doubt, too.
Well, one of the lines that jumps out, "Must nostalgia walk like a prince through all our rooms?"
I think a lot of us are preoccupied, especially around the holidays and Thanksgiving, especially with our past and our history. And so it's a time, I think, to dwell on the passage of time and where we've come from and where we're at and where we're going.
And it's not always a prince. It's sometimes a pauper.
Sometimes it's a pauper, yes.
Yeah. What about suburbs? A theme that runs throughout the book. It's, you know, you have several poems. It's sort of an ongoing dialogue with you and suburbs. They're entitled Dear Suburban. We're reminded, here's a line, "Oh, satellite town, your bright possibility born again in drywall," and the diary with the trick lock. We didn't have one of those. but also that scared need to whiten or clean a surface, plywood or lawn.
Right.
You know, the suburbs, the perfection there.
Sure. Well, that's the poem that opens the book. And I grew up in the suburbs, and a lot of people have and do and still live there. And I think it represents, the suburbs represent, I suppose, the American dream in some way. I think when it's sort of imagined in our culture, we think of a place that's safe and green and pastoral and relatively quiet and communal and with the white picket fence and two cars in the driveway and kids in the yard. And I guess I was just trying to interrogate that dream somewhat. And in order to do that, I had to go back to my own experience growing up in the suburbs in the 70s and 80s. I was away for a while living in cities, and 7 or 8 years ago, I moved to Greensboro, North Carolina, where I feel like I've returned to the suburbs, a different suburb. And moving to that suburb brought back memories of my childhood. They resonated with me quite deeply. And I also, my wife and I had two children. And so watching them grow up there brought a lot of that experience back. So that first Dear Suburb poem is more of a reminiscence.
Well, you're critical, obviously, of some of the uniformity of
yes.
the suburbs. But then you also write, "Amazed I can thrive here so close to a city's lost eminence, where you bring a golden stillness to everything I touch, where I go whole years without suffering so much as a splinter."
Yes. It's speaking directly, I think, to the good fortune I feel and the prosperity I feel. But then there's also a bit of, I don't know, wonder or maybe even doubt that what makes this prosperity possible. And I hope that the book is suggesting a certain kind of context that that the suburbs aren't this – they don't exist in a vacuum. There are other dynamic things going on in the world, and it's related to those things. And so I'm hoping to suggest that as well.
What are you saying, though, about – I mean, that's recent history.
Yes.
Growing up in the suburb. What are you saying about the past history?
Well, I think I'm a poet, and so I feel like it's my job to shed light on not only my life but the life of the people I see around me. And in order to learn, I grew up loving history. I studied history in high school and college, as well as English. And so my poems have always been inflected with that sensibility that if you want to take stock of the present or examine it, you might do well to go back and explore what led up to it. And so a lot of the poems are inflected with or informed by historical events. A couple of the poems dwell on the Kennedy legacy, for example. I think there are a few others that explore the Irish migration to America. My family, on both sides of my family, I have Irish ancestors. And so these things have personal connection, but I guess I'm trying to connect them to larger stories as well. I'm very much interested in telling personal stories, but stories that are seated within the context of the larger dynamics of a culture and history and those sorts of things.
You mentioned the Kennedys. There are two poems about the Kennedys. Love Field talks about President Kennedy arriving in Dallas mm-hmm. with First Lady Jackie
sure.
Kennedy the day he was assassinated, November 22nd, 1963. The other is at the Ambassador Hotel, and it's, of course, the assassination of Robert Kennedy in
yes.
Los Angeles 5 years later, 1968. Could you read a little bit
sure.
Of
I'm
the
happy.
Love Field? The plane arriving, mm-hmm. the first couple disembarking, the photographers who are there, and the roses that are given to her.
Yes. And who knows what's truth, what's myth, or if they arrive as hawks or doves, brave with risk in a bright and swirling land where the dust seems to crown from its own gray dust. Here's the raw footage. Here's the film clicking in the projector. And, as all things seen through it are black and white, isn't it important to note her roses are red and not yellow, and that neither of them squints in the bright Texas sun? If you can stand what the light inside the darkness does to your eyes, watch them pause there for a moment, our champion, our grace, in that high noon that holds all the freshness of the morning.
It resonates because it's about Americans, but also it's about this time.
Yes, I certainly feel a great deal of gratitude, especially, you know, at this time of year for not only my family, but also for our country and the project of our country, which is ongoing and sometimes sticky and uncomfortable. But it feels very alive to me, and I hope that the book reflects some sense of faith and joy in that project. And thanks.
Pick a passage with that in mind.
I'll end with I think it's the final Dear Suburb poem with a passage near at the end of that poem. And then you remind me of the glory of a city on a hill, which I've tried in 8 different ways to refute. And you say we both want a hornet at the center of a screen. And then I confess, as if you give a damn, that I love, in fact, your highways and lawns, these raw lots developers bought for a song.
That's David Roderick. His new collection of poetry is The Americans. David, thank you. And again, happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving, Robin. Thank you for having me.